She probed with a searching light, revealing obscure areas of myself, unseen features of my face and body, making me become aware of them, understand them, see them for the first time. I discovered I had black eyes with a sparkle that attracted other eyes like a magnet, and that my nose was neither big nor rounded, but full and smooth with the fullness of strong passion which could turn to lust. My body was slender, my thighs tense, alive with muscle, ready at any moment to grow even more taut. I realized that I had not hated my mother, nor loved my uncle, nor really known Bayoumi or any other man who belonged to his gang. Sharifa said to me one day, "Neither Bayoumi nor any of his cronies realized your worth, because you failed to value yourself highly enough. A man does not know a woman's value, Fardous. She is the one who determines her value. The higher you price yourself, the more he will realize what you are really worth and be prepared to pay with the means at his disposal. And if he has no means, he will steal from someone else to give you what you demand." I was seized with wonder and asked her, "Am I really of any value, Sharifa?" "You are beautiful and have culture." "Culture," I said. "All I have is a secondary school certificate." "You belittle yourself, Fardous. I never got further than a primary school certificate." "And do you have a price?" I asked cautiously. "Of course. Nobody can touch me without paying a very high price. You are younger than I am, and more cultured, and nobody should be able to come near you without paying twice as much as what is paid to me." "But I cannot ask for anything from a man." "Don't ask for anything. That's not your affair. It's mine." Can the Nile and the sky and the trees change? I had changed, so why not the Nile and the color of the trees? When I opened the window every morning, I could see the Nile flow by, contemplate the green of the water and the trees, the vivid green light in which everything seemed to bathe, feel the power of life of my body, of the hot blood in my veins. My body filled with a warmth as soft as the touch of the silken clothes in which I dressed, or the silken bed in which I slept. My nose filled with the fragrance of roses wafted across the open spaces. I let myself sink in this feeling of warmth and softness, drown in the perfume of gentle roses, savor the comfort of the silken sheets as I stretched my legs, and of the smooth pillow under my head. I drank in the liquid softness through my nose, my mouth, my ears, through every pore in my body with a thirst which knew no end. At night, moonbeams flowed over me, silky and white, like the fingers of the man who lay by my side. His nails, too, were clean and white, not like Bayoumi's nails, which were black as the night, nor like my uncle's nails, with their edge of dark earth on the underside. I would close my lids and let my body bathe in the silvery light, let the silken fingers touch my face and lips, move down to my neck and bury themselves between my breasts. I would nurse them between my breasts for a while, leave them to slip down over my belly and then below it to the place between my thighs. Deep inside my body, I could feel a strange trembling. At first it was like pleasure, a pleasure akin to pain. It ended with pain, a pain which felt like pleasure. It belonged to a distant past, had been with me somehow right from the beginning. I had experienced it long ago, but forgotten it at the time. Yet it seemed to go back even further than my life, to some day before I was born, like a thing arising out of an ancient wound in an organ which had ceased to be mine on the body of a woman who was no longer me. One day I asked Sharifa, "Why don't I feel anything?"
"We work, Fardous, we just work. Don't mix feeling with work."
"But I want to feel, Sharifa," I exclaimed.
"You will get nothing out of feeling except pain."
"Is there no pleasure to be had, even the slightest pleasure?" She burst out laughing.
I could see her small white pointed teeth with the gold tooth in the middle. She went quiet all of a sudden and looked at me gravely, then said, "Does it not give you pleasure to eat roast chicken and rice? Does it not give you pleasure to wear these soft, silky clothes? Do you not feel pleasure at living in this warm, clean house, with its windows overlooking the Nile? Does it not give you pleasure when you open the window every morning and look out at the Nile, and the sky and the trees? Isn't all this sufficient for you? Why do you ask for more?" It was not out of greed that I was thinking of other things. One morning I had opened the window as usual, but the Nile was no longer there. I knew the Nile was in the same place, its waters stretched out before my eyes, but I could no longer see it, as though the human eye is incapable of seeing what is within its reach. The perfumes which I had all around me, under my nose, they too had disappeared. I was unable to detect their odour, as though my nose, just like my eyes, could no longer register the things which were there in front of it. The softness, the silk, the comfortable bed, all the things I knew were still there, no longer existed for me. I never used to leave the house. In fact, I never even left the bedroom. Day and night, I lay on the bed, crucified, and every hour a man would come in. There were so many of them. I did not understand where they could possibly have come from, for they were all married, all educated, all carrying swollen leather bags and swollen leather wallets in their inner pockets. Their swollen heavy paunches hung down with too much food, and their sweat ran copiously, filling my nostrils with a fetid smell like stagnant water, as though it had been held back in their bodies for a long time. I turned my face away, but they insisted on pulling it back, on burying my nose in the smell of their bodies. They dug their long nails into my flesh, and I would close my lips tightly, trying to stifle any expression of pain, to hold back a scream, but in spite of my efforts they would part and let out a low, muffled moan. Often the man would hear it and mutter stupidly in my ear, "Do you feel good?" In answer, I would purse my lips and prepare to spit in his face, but he would start biting them with his teeth. I could feel his thick saliva between my lips, and with a push of the tongue sent it back into his mouth. Among all these men, there was only one man who was not stupid and did not ask me if I was feeling good. Instead, he queried, "Do you feel any pain?" "Yes," I said.
"What's your name?"
"Ferdus, and you?"
"I'm Fauzi."
"How did you realize I was feeling pain?"
"Because I feel you."
"You can feel me?" I exclaimed with amazement.
"Yes," he said. "What about you? Do you also feel me?"
"I don't feel anything."
"Why?"
"I do not know. Sharifa told me work is work, and that feelings do not come in where work is concerned." He gave a short laugh and kissed me on the lips.
"Sharifa's fooling you, and making money out of you, while all you get out of it is the pain."
I cried. He wiped my tears away and took me in his arms. I closed my eyes, and he kissed me gently on the lids. I heard him whisper,
"Do you want to sleep?"
"Yes."
"Then sleep in my arms."
"But what about Sharifa?"
"Don't be afraid of Sharifa."
"And you, aren't you afraid of her?" He gave another of his short laughs and said,
"She is the one who fears me."
I was still asleep in my bed with my eyes closed, when I heard soft voices from beyond the wall separating Sharifa's room from mine. I heard her speaking to a man whose voice sounded familiar.
"You're going to take her away from me?"
"I shall marry her, Sharifa."
"Not you. You don't marry."
"That's all over. Now I'm older and want a son."
"So that he can inherit your wealth?"
"Don't be sarcastic at my expense, Sharifa. If I wanted, I could have become a millionaire, but I'm a man who lives for the pleasures of life. I earn money to spend it. I refuse to be a slave, either to money or to love."
"Do you love her, Fauzi?"
"Am I capable of love? You told me once that I'd lost the ability to love.
You neither love nor marry. All you want to do is take her away from me, just as you took Camellia away before.
It was Camellia who came with me.
She fell in love with you, didn't she?
So women love me, is that my fault?
Oh, woe betide any woman that loves you, Fauzi.
That's if I'm not in love with her myself.
And can you love a woman?
Sometimes it does happen.
Were you in love with me once?
Are you going to start harking back to that question again? I haven't got time to waste, as you know, and I'm taking Fardus with me.
You're not taking her.
I am taking her.
Are you threatening me, Fauzi? I'm not afraid of your threats anymore. You can't get the police onto me. I have more friends and connections in the police than you have.
Am I a man who has recourse to the police? Only a weak man needs to do that, and do you think I am a weak man, Sharifa?
What do you mean?
You know what I mean.
You're going to beat me up, is that it?
It's a long time since I last hit you. It looks as though you're yearning for a good hiding.
If you hit me, I will hit back, Fauzi.
That's fine. We'll see who's the stronger of the two.
If you so much as lay a finger on me, I'll get shouty onto you.
Who the hell is this shouty of yours? Do you have another man? Are you in love with someone else? Do you dare?
I was unable to hear Sharifa's reply through the wall. Perhaps her voice was so low that it did not reach me, or he may have covered her mouth with his hand before she could say anything more, for I heard what seemed to me the sound of a hand being clapped over a mouth, followed by another sound very much like that of someone's hand patting a face. Then came a series of muffled noises. I was unable to tell whether they were gentle slaps on the face or violent kisses. But after a short while I heard Sharifa protesting, "No, Fauzi, no." His voice sounded like an angry hiss.
"No, no what, you slut?"
The bed creaked under them. Then once again I heard Sharifa's voice like a series of gasps, followed by the same protesting tone. "No, Fauzi, for the Prophet's sake, you must not, you must not." Through the wall came his panting, angry hiss again.
"What the hell, woman? Must not what and Prophet what? Who is this shouty? I'll cut his throat."
The creaking grew louder under the weight of the two bodies, as they embraced each other, wrestled with one another, alternately closing in and separating in a continuous movement, which soon mounted to a strangely rapid, almost mad frenzy, shaking the bed under them violently with the shudders of a wild animal short of breath. The floor seemed to shake and pant. Then it was the wall. Even the bed on which I was lying picked up the frenzied rhythm and began to shake. The violent shaking went to my head. It was as though I awakened suddenly to what was going on around me. I saw Fauzi's face take shape out of a mist, as if in a dream, and I heard his voice echoing in my ears again.
"Sharifa's fooling you. She's making money out of you."
Then came Sharifa's voice as she said, "If you hit me, Fauzi, I will hit back." I opened my eyes. My body was stretched out on the bed without a man beside me, and the room around was dark and empty. I walked on the tip of my toes to Sharifa's room and found her lying naked with Fauzi at her side. I tiptoed back to my room, put on the first dress I could lay my hands on, took my little bag, and hurried down the flights of stairs into the street. It was night, a pitch-black night with no moon. A bitterly cold winter night, with the streets of the city completely deserted, and with the windows and the doors of the houses all firmly closed to prevent the slightest draft of air from penetrating. There I was, walking through the cold, wearing a thin, almost transparent dress, and yet I did not feel it. I was surrounded by darkness on all sides, with nowhere to go, but I was no longer afraid. Nothing in the streets was capable of scaring me any longer, and the coldest wind could no longer bite into my body. Had my body changed? Had I been transported into another woman's body? And where had my own, my real body gone? I started to examine the fingers of my hands.
The fingers were mine. They had not changed. Long, slender fingers. One of the men once said he had never seen fingers like these before. He said they looked strong and clever, that they possessed a language of their own. When he kissed them, they seemed to speak to him with a voice he could almost hear. I laughed and brought my fingers close up to my ears, but could hear nothing. I laughed again, and this time my laughter echoed in my ears. I was taken aback to hear my own laughter in the silent night. I looked around me cautiously, fearing that someone might hear me laughing alone and carry me off to the Abbasaya Mental Hospital. At first I could see nothing, but a moment later I glimpsed a policeman approaching in the dark. He came right up to me, caught me by the arm and said,
"Where are you going?"
"I don't know."
"Will you come with me?"
"Where to?"
"To my house."
"No, I have no trust in men anymore." I opened my small bag and showed him my secondary school certificate. I told him I was looking for a job with my secondary or even with my primary school certificate, that if I did not find something this way, I was prepared to do any work. He said,
"I'll pay you. Don't think I want to have you for nothing. I'm not like other policemen. How much do you want?"
"How much do I want? I don't know."
"Don't play games with me, and don't try to haggle with me either, or I'll take you off to the police station."
"Why? I haven't done anything."
"You're a prostitute, and it's my duty to arrest you and others of your kind, to clean up the country and protect respectable families from the likes of you. But I don't want to use force. Perhaps we can agree, quietly, without a fuss. I'll give you £1, a whole pound. What do you say to that?"
I tried to shake free of him, but he held onto my arm and started to walk me away from where we were standing. He took me through one dark, narrow alley after another, then through a wooden door into a room, where he made me lie down on a bed. He took off his clothes. I closed my eyes as I felt the familiar weight bear down on me, the familiar movement of fingers with dirty black nails travelling over my body, the panting breath, the foul, sticky sweat, the shaking of the bed and the floor and the walls as though the world was turning round and round. I opened my eyes, dragged my body off the bed, put on my dress and then leant my head, my tired head, against the door for a moment before leaving. I heard his voice say from behind me,
"What are you waiting for? I have no money on me tonight. I'll give you money the next time."
I walked away through the narrow streets. It was still night and the air was bitterly cold. Now rain had started to fall, turning the dusty ground under my feet to mud. There were piles of rubbish in front of the houses, and the smell of rot seemed to envelop me on all sides, to overcome me, to drown me under it, and I kept walking faster, trying to escape, to get out of the narrow twisting streets and alleys onto a tarred road, any tarred road on which I could step without sinking my shoes in mud. When I reached one of the main roads, the rain was still pouring down over my head. I sought shelter at one of the bus stops, took a handkerchief out of my bag and started to wipe my face, my hair, my eyes. A white light penetrated to my eyes, and at first I thought it was the white colour of my handkerchief, but when I took it away, the light continued to shine brightly in my eyes, like the headlamps of a bus. I thought it was dawn, and that the buses had already started. But it was not a bus. It was a car which had pulled up in front of me with its headlights full in my eyes. Then a man got out and circled quickly round the car, opened the door on my side, bowed slightly, and then very politely said,
"Please do get in out of the rain."
I was shivering with cold, and my light dress was clinging to my body, soaked in rain. My breasts were showing almost naked under my dress, the nipples standing out in two dark circles. As he helped me into the car, he pressed his arm against them. It was warm inside his house, and he helped me out of my dress, took off my muddy shoes, and washed my body with warm water and soap. Then he carried me to the bed. I closed my eyes as I felt the weight press heavily down on my chest and belly, and the fingers move over my body. But the nails were clean and manicured. The panting breath had an odour of scent, and the sweat ran sticky but fresh. When I opened my eyes, I was bathing in sunlight. I looked around, unable to recognize where I was. There I was, lying in an elegant bedroom, with a stranger standing in front of me. I got up quickly and put on my dress and shoes. As I picked up my little bag and started to move towards the door, he stretched out his arm and slipped a £10 note between my fingers. It was as if he had lifted a veil from my eyes, and I was seeing for the first time. The movement of my hand as I clasped the £10 note solved the enigma in one swift, sweeping movement, tore away the shroud that covered up a truth I had in fact experienced when still a child, when for the first time my father gave me a piaster, a coin to hold in my hand and be mine. My father had never given me money. I worked in the fields and worked in the house, and together with my mother ate the scraps of food left over from my father. And on those days when there was no food left over from him, I went to bed without supper. On the Eid Kibir, I saw the children buy candy from a sweet shop. I went to my mother, crying loudly, "Give me a piaster." She answered, "I have no piasters, it's your father who has the piasters." So I went in search of my father and asked him for a piaster. He hit me on the hand and shouted, "I have no piasters." But a moment later he called me back and said, "I'll give you a piaster if Allah is bountiful to us and we manage to sell the buffalo before she dies." After that I saw him praying and exhorting Allah to delay the hour of her death. But the buffalo died before anyone could do anything. My father ceased his prayers and exhortations to Allah throughout the Eid, and whenever my mother said something to him, he would jump at her and give her a beating. I refrained from asking him for a piaster, but later, on the occasion of the Eid al-Sighir, I noticed the sweets piled up in the shop and said to my father, "Give me a piaster." This time he said,
"Do you ask for a piaster first thing in the morning? Go and clean under the animals and load the ass and take her to the fields. At the end of the day I shall give you a piaster."
And in fact, when I returned from the fields at the end of that day, he gave me the piaster. It was the first piaster he had ever given me, the first piaster that was all mine, to put in the palm of my hand and surround with my fingers and squeeze. It was not my father's and not my mother's, but mine. Mine to do with it what I wanted, to buy what I wanted, to eat with it whatever I desired, whether sweets or carob or molastics or anything else I might choose. The sun was shining brightly that day. I walked with a quick, energetic step, my right fist clenched tightly over something in my palm, something really valuable, not just a piaster this time, but a whole £10 note. It was the first time I had held such a big note in my hand. As a matter of fact, it was the first time my fingers had even touched a note of that kind. The sudden contact sent a strange tautness through my body, an inner contraction as though something had jumped inside me and shaken my body with a violence which was almost painful. I felt as if something was pulsating out from a wound buried deep in my guts. When I stretched the muscles of my back, stood upright and breathed deeply, it hurt. I could feel it rise up to my belly like a shiver, like blood beating strongly through the veins. The hot blood in my chest rose to my neck, swept through to my throat to become a flow of warm, rich saliva, bringing with it a savour of pleasure so strong, so poignant that it was almost bitter. I swallowed my saliva several times as I stood facing a glass partition, behind which chickens were roasting on a brightly burning flame. My eyes gazed at them as they turned on the iron skewer over the leaping flames. I chose a table near a window so that it was covered in sunlight, and ordered a fat brown chicken. I sat down and started to eat it slowly, very slowly, chewing every morsel, keeping it in my mouth for a long moment before swallowing. My mouth was full like that of a child stuffing itself with sweets, and the food had a strong, delicious taste, a strange, powerful sweetness about it, like the sweetness of the molastic bought with my first piaster. Yet that was not the first molastic I had tasted, for my mother had bought me molastics before, but it was the first one I had chosen myself from amongst the other sweets in the shop, the first one bought with my own piastre. The waiter bent over the table to place the other plates in front of me. He stretched out a hand with a plateful of food, but his eyes looked elsewhere, did not linger over my plate. The movement of his eyes as they avoided my plate cut like a knife through the veil which hung over my eyes, and I realized this was the first time in my life I was eating without being watched by two eyes gazing into my plate to see how much food I took. Ever since I was born, those two eyes had always been there, wide open, staring, unflinching, following every morsel of food on my plate. Was it possible that a mere piece of paper could make such a change? Why had I not realized this before? Was I really unaware of this throughout the years? No. Now that I thought about it, I could see that I had known it for a very long time, right from the start, when I was born and opened my eyes to look at my father for the first time. All I could see of him was a fist, its fingers closed strongly over something in the palm of his hand. He never opened up his fingers, and even when he did, always kept something behind in his hand, something bright in colour and circular in shape, something he used to handle gently with his big rough fingers, or drop on a smooth stone so that it let out a ringing sound. I was still sitting in the sun. The £10 note lay in my bag, for I had not yet paid for my meal. I opened my bag to take it out. The waiter approached, bowed over the table with a movement of respectful humility, and started to collect the plates. He kept his eyes away from my bag, looking all the while in another direction, as though avoiding the £10 note. I had seen this movement of the eyes before, this lowering of the lids, this almost imperceptible glance at my hand. It reminded me of my husband, Sheikh Mahmoud, as he kneeled in prayer, his eyes half closed, of the glances he stole now and then at my plate, and of my uncle as he followed the lines in his book with peering eyes while his hand stole out from behind, searching for my thigh. The waiter was still standing upright by my side, his half-closed lids drooping over the eyes, his stealthy way of glancing aside were the same. I held the £10 note in my hand, and he watched it through the corner of one eye, while his other eye looked away as though shunning the forbidden parts of a woman's body. I was seized with a feeling of wonder. Could it be that the £10 note I held in my hand was as illicit and forbidden as the thrill of sacrilegious pleasure? I almost opened my mouth to ask the waiter, "Who has decided that the £10 note is to be considered forbidden?" But I kept my lips pressed tightly together, for I had, in fact, known the answer all along. Found it out many years ago, right from the moment when my father hit me over the hand when I first held it out for a coin. It was a lesson oft repeated as time went by. My mother had once beaten me for losing a piastre in the marketplace and returning home without it. My uncle was in the habit of giving me money, but warned me not to mention anything about it to my mother. My uncle's wife used to hide the piastres in her bodice whenever she heard me approaching before she had finished counting. My husband counted his piastres almost every day, but as soon as he saw me coming, he put them away. And Sharifa, too, would count the pound notes and stack them quickly in some secret recess the moment she heard my voice. And so, as the years went by, I began to look in the other direction every time I saw someone count his money, or even take a few coins out of his or her pocket. It was as though money was a shameful thing, made to be hidden, an object of sin, which was forbidden to me and yet permissible for others, as though it had been made legitimate only for them. I was on the point of asking the waiter who it was that had decided all this, who it was that had decided for whom it was permissible and to whom it should be forbidden. But I pressed my lips even more tightly together and held back the words. Instead, I held out the £10 note to him. He kept his head bent downwards, his eyes seemed to stray far away as he put out his hand and took it from me. From that day onwards, I ceased to bend my head or to look away. I walked through the streets with my head held high and my eyes looking straight ahead. I looked people in the eyes, and if I saw someone count his money, I fixed it with an unwinking gaze. I continued to walk the streets. The sun was on my back. It flowed through me with its rays. The warmth of good food ran through my body with the blood in my veins. The rest of the £10 note nestled safely in my pocket. My footsteps on the dark tarmac road struck the ground with force, with a new elation, like the elation of a child that has just pulled a toy to pieces and discovered the secret of how it works. A man came up to me and whispered. I looked him straight in the eye and said, "No." Another man came up to me and muttered something in a secretive voice which could barely be heard. I examined him carefully from head to toes and said, "No." He inquired, "Why no?" I replied, "Because there are plenty of men, and I want to choose with whom to go." So he said,
"Well then, why not choose me?"
"Because your fingernails are dirty, and I like them to be clean." A third man approached. He pronounced the secret word, the key to the riddle I had solved. I asked, "How much will you pay?"
£10.
"No, 20.
"Your wishes are my orders."
And he paid me on the spot. How many were the years of my life that went by before my body and myself became really mine, to do with them as I wished? How many were the years of my life that were lost before I tore my body and myself away from the people who held me in their grasp since the very first day? Now I could decide on the food I wanted to eat, the house I preferred to live in, refuse the man for whom I felt an aversion no matter what the reason, and choose the man I wished to have, even if it was only because he was clean and well manicured. A quarter of a century had passed, for I was 25 years old when I first started to have a clean apartment of my own, overlooking the main street, engage a cook who prepared the food I ordered, and employ someone to arrange for my appointments at the hours which suited me, and in accordance with the terms which I considered acceptable. My bank account kept mounting all the time. I now had free time in which I could relax, go for walks or to the cinema or the theatre, time to read the newspapers and to discuss politics with the few close friends I selected from the many who hovered around me, seeking to strike up a friendship. One of my friends was called Dotter. He was a journalist, or a writer or something of the sort. I preferred him to my other friends because he was a man of culture, and I had developed a liking for culture ever since I had started to go to school and had learned to read, but especially during this last period, since I could now buy books. I had a large library in my apartment, and it was here that I spent most of my free time. On the walls I had hung some good paintings, and right in the middle was my secondary school certificate, surrounded by an expensive frame. I never received anyone in the library. It was a very special room reserved for me alone. My bedroom was where I received my guests. The first time Dotter came to my house, before I had time to lift the embroidered quilt which covered my bed, he said,
"Wait a moment. Let's talk to one another for a while. I prefer talking to anything else."
I was facing the bed with my back to him, so I did not see his expression when he pronounced these words. But his voice in my ear had a different tone, a tone I had never heard in the other men's voices. I turned round so that I could see his face. I was not in the habit of turning round in order to look at the man's face. I would lift the embroidered quilt off the bed without looking at him, without even trying to glimpse something of his features. I used to keep my eyes tightly closed all the time, and only open them when the weight pressing down on me had lifted from my body. I turned round, raised my head, and looked straight into his face. I could see that his features, like his voice, had something about them that I had never come across before. His head seemed too big for his body, and his eyes looked small relative to his face. His skin was dark, but his eyes were not black, although I was not able to distinguish their exact colour in the dimmed electric light. His wide forehead started high up and swept down to a small nose. Below the nose, his upper lip was shaven, and the thinning hair looked scanty on the over-large head. Since I stood there facing him without saying a word, he thought I'd not heard him. He repeated,
"Let's talk a little. I prefer talking to anything else."
"Nevertheless, you will have to pay me like they all do. The time you can spend with me is fixed, and every minute counts as money."
"You make me feel like I'm in a clinic. Why don't you hang up a price list in the waiting room? Do you also have emergency visits?"
There was a note of irony in his voice, but I could not see why, so I said, "Are you being sarcastic about my work or about the medical profession?"
"Both,"
he said. "Are they similar to one another?"
"Yes,"
he said.
"Except that a doctor, while carrying out his duties, feels he's worthy of respect."
"What about me?" I exclaimed.
"You are not respectable,"
he replied, but before the words, "not respectable," had even reached my ears, my hands rose to cover them quickly, but they penetrated into my head like the sharp tip of a plunging dagger. He closed his lips tightly. A sudden deep silence enveloped the room, but the words continued to echo in my ears, took refuge in their innermost depths, buried themselves in my head like some palpable material object, like a body as sharp as the edge of a knife which had cut its way through my ears and the bones of my head to the brain inside. My hands were still raised to cover my ears and shut out the sound of his voice. His voice was no longer audible to me, and when he spoke I could not see the movement of his lips, as though they remained invisible. The words seemed to emerge from between them, to escape of their own accord. I could almost see them as they traversed the space separating his lips from my ears, like tangible things with a well-defined surface, exactly like blobs of spit, as though he had aimed them at me from between his lips. When he tried to brush his lips against mine, his words were still resonating in my mind. I pushed him away and said, "My work is not worthy of respect. Why then do you join in it with me?" He tried to take me by force, but I repelled his advances, then went to the door and opened it, and he immediately left. But although Do'a went out of my house, his words did not leave my ears with him that night. They had cut their way through to my mind in a moment of time which now belonged to the past. But no force on earth could turn back the hands of time one single moment. Before that moment, my mind had been calm, tranquil, undisturbed. Every night I used to lay my head on the pillow and sleep deeply, right through the night until morning. But now, my head vibrated with an incessant movement that kept on without respite, throughout the day and throughout the night, like the ebb and flow of waves on a shore, seething and foaming and bubbling like boiling water. A sound like the roar of an angry sea went back and forth from my ears to the pillow and from the pillow to my ears. In this storm I could no longer tell which was the rushing sound of the sea and which was the blowing sound of the wind, for everything had become just a series of blows, which followed one another like night and day, like my heartbeats racing in a row like a hammer in my head ringing out one phrase with every blow, "not respectable, not respectable," hammering it out, blow after blow, into my bones, outside my bones, over my bed, on the floor, in the dining room, on the stairs, in the streets, on the walls. Wherever I went, the strokes of the hammer beat down on my head, on my face, on my body, on my bones. Wherever I went, the words clung to me, cold and sticky like spit, like the spit of an insult echoing in the ear, like the spit of insolent eyes over my naked body, like the spit of all the degrading words I had heard ringing in my ears at one or other time, like the spit of all the brazen eyes that undressed me and examined my nakedness with a slow insolence, like the spit of courteous eyes that looked aside as I shed my clothes, hiding their contempt under a respectful guise. One phrase, one small phrase composed of two words, threw a glaring light on the whole of my life and made me see it as it really was. The veil was torn from my eyes. I was opening them for the first time, seeing my life in a new way. I was not a respected woman. It was something I had not known before. It was as well that I had remained ignorant of the fact. I was able to eat well and sleep deeply. Was there any way of uprooting this new knowledge from my mind? After all, it was only like some pain, cutting with the sharp edge of a knife through my head. In fact, it was not even a knife, but only a small phrase composed of two words, a small phrase which had penetrated like an arrow into my brain, before I had the time to clap my hands over my ears and keep it out. Was there anything that could uproot it from my head the way they extract a bullet or excise a tumour from the brain? Nothing in the world seemed capable of making me the same woman I had been before I heard the two words pronounced by the man that night. From that moment onwards, I became another woman. My previous life was behind me. I did not want to go back to it at any price, no matter what torture and suffering I might have to go through, even if I were to know hunger and cold and utter destitution. Come what may, I had to become a respectable woman, even if the price were to be my life. I was prepared to do anything to put a stop to the insults that my ears had grown used to hearing, to keep the brazen eyes from running all over my body. I still had my secondary school certificate, my certificate of merit, and a sharp, decisive mind determined to find respectable work. I still had 2 black eyes that looked people straight in the face and were ready to counter the shifty, leering glances thrown at me as I made my way through life. Every time there was an advertisement, I applied for the job. I went to all the ministries, departments, and company offices where there might be a vacancy. And finally, by dint of these efforts, I at last found a job with one of the big industrial concerns. Now I had a small office of my own, separated from the chairman's spacious room by a small door. Above the door protruded a red light, and near it was a bell. When the bell rang, I would push open the door and enter his room. There he sat behind his desk, a man of about 50, fat and bald, smoking all day. Some of his teeth were missing, and those that remained were stained yellow with black patches. He would look up from his papers with a cigarette dangling from his lips and say,
"Today I'm out for everybody except the really top people. Understood?"
And before I could ask him what he meant by the really top people, his head would bend over his papers once more and almost disappear in the clouds of cigarette smoke. After the day's work was over, I would pick up my little bag and go home. What I called home was not a house or a flat, but merely a small room without a toilet. I rented it from an old woman who got up every morning at dawn to pray, then knocked at my door. My work did not start until 8 o'clock in the morning, but I was always up at 5, so that I would have the time to take my towel and go down to join the queue of men and women standing in front of the bathroom. For my meagre salary did not permit me to live anywhere else than in this house, situated in a narrow back street with rows of small shops, where plumbers and blacksmiths plied their trade. I had to wind my way through several narrow streets and walk up part of the main road before reaching the bus stop. When the bus came to a halt, every one of the men and women at the stop would struggle to push his way in. I would join the throng of jostling, fighting bodies. But once inside, it was as though I had stepped into an oven where the packed bodies had fused into a single mass. The building of the company where I worked had 2 doors, one for the more important higher-level employees which remained unguarded, and another for the lesser officials which was guarded by one of the employees, very much like some kind of a doorkeeper. He used to sit behind a little desk with a big register in front of him. The employees signed in the register when they arrived in the morning or left after the day's work was over. I used to run down the long list for my name and sign opposite it. Then, next to my name, the man would write down the exact time, to the minute, of my arrival. When I left at the end of the day, he would register my departure time with the same precision. But the higher officials would come and go as they pleased. They all rode in cars, big or small. I used to glimpse them sitting in their cars as I stood on one leg in the bus, hemmed in by a mass of bodies. One day, as I was running after the bus, trying to find a foothold onto which I could jump, one of them saw me. His look was that of a top executive to a minor official. I felt it land on my head and then drop down to my body like cold water. The blood rushed to my head and my foot tripped over something, so I came to a sudden stop. He drove up to where I stood and said,
"I can give you a lift."
I looked into his eyes. They clearly said, "You're a poor, miserable employee, unworthy of esteem, running after a bus to catch it. I'll take you in my car because your female body has aroused me. It is an honor for you to be desired by a respected official like myself, and who knows, maybe someday in the future, I can help you to get a rise before the others." When I said nothing, he thought I'd not heard him, so he repeated,
"I can give you a lift."
I quietly replied, "The price of my body is much higher than the price that can be paid for it with a pay rise." His eyes widened with surprise. Maybe he was wondering how it was that I had read his thoughts so easily. I watched him as he drove off at high speed. After I had spent 3 years in the company, I realized that as a prostitute, I had been looked upon with more respect and been valued more highly than all the female employees, myself included. In those days, I lived in a house with a private toilet. I could enter it at any time and lock the door on myself without anybody hurrying me. My body was never hemmed in by other bodies in the bus, nor was it a prey to male organs pressing up against it from in front and behind. Its price was not cheap, and could not be paid for by a mere rise in salary, an invitation to dinner, a drive along the Nile in somebody's car. Nor was it considered the price I was supposed to pay in order to gain my director's goodwill, or avoid the chairman's anger. Throughout those 3 years, not once did a top executive or higher official so much as touch me. I had no wish to humiliate my body at a low price, especially after I had become accustomed to being paid very highly for whatever services I rendered. I even refused invitations to lunch or to a drive along the Nile. After a long day's work, I preferred to go home and sleep. I felt sorry for the other girls who were guileless enough to offer their bodies and their physical efforts every night in return for a meal or a good yearly report or just to ensure that they would not be treated unfairly or discriminated against or transferred. Every time one of the directors made me a proposition, I would say to him, "It's not that I value my honor and my reputation more than the other girls, but my price is much higher than theirs." I came to realize that a female employee is more afraid of losing her job than a prostitute is of losing her life. An employee is scared of losing her job and becoming a prostitute because she does not understand that the prostitute's life is in fact better than hers, and so she pays the price of her illusory fears with her life, her health, her body, and her mind. She pays the highest price for things of the lowest value. I now knew that all of us were prostitutes who sold themselves at varying prices, and that an expensive prostitute was better than a cheap one. I also knew that if I lost my job, all I would lose with it was the miserable salary, the contempt I could read every day in the eyes of the higher-level executives when they looked at the lesser female officials, the humiliating pressure of male bodies on mine when I rode in the bus, and the long morning queue in front of a perpetually overflowing toilet. I was not too keen on keeping my job, and perhaps for that very reason, the company authorities seemed to become more and more keen to keep me. I did not make any special effort to curry the favour of one or other of the higher officials. On the contrary, it was they who started vying with one another for my favours. And so the word went round that I was an honourable woman, and a highly respected official, in fact, the most honourable and the most highly considered of all the female officials in the company. It was also said that none of the men had succeeded in breaking my pride, and that not a single high-ranking official had been able to make me bow my head or lower my eyes to the ground. But I liked my job, despite everything. At work I met my women colleagues. I could talk to them and they could talk to me. My office was better than the room in which I lived. There was no queue outside the office toilets and nobody hurried me when I was inside. The grounds around the office building had a small garden in which I could sit for a while at the end of the day before going home. Sometimes night would fall and I would still be there, in no hurry to return to my dreary room, the dirty back streets and the foul-smelling toilets. One day, as I sat there, one of the employees saw me. For a moment he was scared by the sight of a dark mass, the size of a human body, crouched motionless in the dark of night. He called out from a distance,
"Who is it? Who is sitting there?"
I said in a sad voice, "It's me, Ferdows." When he came nearer, he recognized me, and seemed surprised to see me sitting there alone, for I was considered one of the best employees in the company, and the best employees were expected to leave immediately the day's work was over. I said I was having a rest because I felt tired. He sat down next to me. His name was Ibrahim. He was a short, stocky man with rather fuzzy black hair and black eyes. I could see them in the night looking at me, and felt they were able to see me despite the dark. Every time I moved my head away, they followed me, held on fast, refusing to let go, Even when I hid my eyes behind my hands, they seemed to pierce through them to what was there behind. But after a while he took hold of my hands, gently pulled them away from my face, and said,
"Firdus, I beg of you, don't cry."
"Let me cry," I said.
"But I've never seen you cry before. What's happened?"
"Nothing, nothing at all."
"That's not possible. Something must have happened."
"Nothing at all has happened," I repeated. He sounded surprised.
"Are you crying for nothing?"
"I don't know why I'm crying. Nothing new has happened in my life." He remained seated by my side in silence. His black eyes wandered into the night, and the tears welled up in them for a moment with a glistening light. He tightened his lips and swallowed hard, and suddenly the light in his eyes went out. Then they started to shine again, but an instant later went dark, like tiny flames snuffed out in the night. He kept pressing his lips together and swallowing hard, but at last I saw two tears overflow from his eyes and drop down on either side. He hid his face with one hand, pulled out a handkerchief with the other, and wiped his nose. "Are you crying, Ibrahim?" I asked.
"No, Firdus."
He hid the handkerchief, swallowed with an effort, and smiled at me. The courtyard around us was plunged in a deep silence. There was not a sound to be heard, and everything was motionless, suspended without movement. The sky above was enveloped in darkness, with not a ray of light from sun or moon. My face was turned towards his, and my eyes looked into his eyes. I could see two rings of pure white surrounding two circles of intense black looking out at me. I continued to gaze into them. The white seemed to grow even whiter and the black to become even blacker, as though light flowed through them from some unknown, mysterious source, neither on earth nor in the heavens, for the earth was enveloped in the dark cloak of night, and the heavens had neither sun nor moon to lighten them up. I held his eyes fast in mine. I reached out and took his hand in mine. The feel of our hands touching was strange, sudden. It made my body tremble with a deep, distant pleasure, older than the age of remembered life, deeper than the consciousness carried within me throughout. I could feel it somewhere in my being, like a part which had been born with me when I was born, but had not grown with me when I had grown, or like something I had known before being born and left behind. At that moment a memory came back to me, and my lips parted to express it in words, but my voice failed to emerge, as though no sooner did I remember than I had already forgotten it. My heart faltered, overcome by its frightened, almost frenzied beating because of something I had just lost or was on the point of losing forever. My fingers grasped at his hand with such violence that no force in the world, no matter how great, could take it away from me. After that night, we only had to meet and my lips would part to say something, but no sooner did I remember it than it was already forgotten. My heart beat with fear, or with an emotion akin to fear. I wanted to reach out and take his hand, but he would enter the premises and leave them without noticing me, and if he looked at me it was in the same way he looked at any other female employee. At a big meeting for the workers, I heard him speak about justice and the abolition of privileges enjoyed by management as compared to the workers. We applauded him enthusiastically and stood at the door for a long time to shake his hand. When my turn came, I held his hand in mine and his eyes in my eyes for a long moment. Sitting at my desk, I would absent-mindedly jot down his name, Ibrahim, on the wooden surface or on the back of my hand, and no sooner did I glimpse him crossing the inner courtyard than I would stand up as though getting ready to rush off and join him. But a moment later, I would sit down again. My friend, Fateya, caught me standing up and sitting down again like that several times. She came up to me and whispered into my ear,
"What's happened to you, Firdus?"
And I would question in a musing voice, "Has Ibrahim forgotten?"
"Forgotten what?"
she would say. "I don't know, Fateya."
"You're living in a dream world, my dear girl."
"That's not true, that's not true, Fateya. It happened." Then she would ask,
"What is it exactly that happened?"
I tried to tell her what had happened, but did not know how to describe it to her, or maybe I could not find anything to say, as if something had happened but I had forgotten exactly what it was, or as if nothing had happened at all. I would close my eyes and try to bring back the scene. The two circles of deep black, surrounded by two rings of intense white, would gradually appear before my eyes. When I stared into them for some time, they would start to expand, rapidly becoming bigger and bigger, so that at a certain moment the black reached the size of the earth and the white grew into a piercingly white mass, as big as the disk of the sun. My eyes would lose themselves in the black and the white until they could no longer perceive either of them. The images before my eyes grew confused. I could no longer distinguish between the faces of my mother and my father, of Wafea and Fateya, of Iqbal and Ibrahim. I opened my eyes wide in panic, like someone threatened with losing their sight. The outlines of Fateya's face were still there, standing out against the dark colour of the earth, or the shining white of the sun.
"Do you love Ibrahim?" she asked.
"Not at all."
"Why then do you tremble whenever you hear his name mentioned?"
"Me? Never. It has never happened. You always exaggerate, Fateya." I heard her say,
"Ibrahim is a fine man and a revolutionary."
"I know, but I am no more than a minor employee. How could Ibrahim possibly fall in love with a poor girl like me?" A revolutionary committee was set up in the company, with Ibrahim as its chairman. I joined the committee and started to work for it day and night, including holidays. It was voluntary work. I no longer worried about my wages. Waiting in the morning queue for the toilet no longer bothered me, and the pressure of bodies surrounding me no longer filled me with humiliation. One day Ibrahim saw me running after the bus, stopped his small car and called out to me. I got in next to him. A moment later I heard him say,
"I admire you, Fardus. If we had just 5 people in the company with your zeal, energy and conviction, we could do almost anything in the world."
I said nothing. I was pressing my little bag against my breast, trying to cover up the pounding of my heart and to make my breathing return to normal. But after a while I realized that my breathing was still hectic. In an attempt to conceal the emotion I felt, I proffered an excuse which sounded rather lame. I'm still out of breath from chasing that bus." He must have realized what I was trying to do, for he just smiled without making any comment. After a while he asked me,
"Do you want to go straight home, or shall we sit somewhere and talk?"
The question took me by surprise, and I answered on the spur of the moment without thinking, "I don't want to go home." Then, in order to cover up the slip I had made, I added quickly, "You must be tired after a long day's work. Perhaps you had better go straight home and rest."
"Maybe it will do me more good to talk to you for a while. That's, of course, if you are not tired yourself and would prefer to rest at home."
Almost unaware of what I was saying, I replied, "Rest. I have never known what it means to rest in my life." I felt his strong, warm hand take hold of mine. I felt myself trembling all through. Even the roots of the hair on my body seemed to move. He asked in a quiet voice,
"Fardus, do you remember the first time we met?"
"Yes."
"Ever since that day, I have been thinking about you."
"And I, too, have been thinking about you."
"I have been trying to hide my feelings, but it's no longer possible."
"So have I." That day, we talked about everything. I described my childhood and what had happened to my life in the past, and he, too, spoke to me of his childhood years and the dreams he had for the future. The next day we met again and talked even more freely about everything. I even spoke to him about things I had hidden from myself and refused to face, and he in turn was very frank with me and hid nothing. On the third day he took me to his small house and I spent the night with him. We talked very quietly for a long time, and when we said all we had to say, we gave ourselves to one another in a warm embrace. It was as though I held the whole world captive in my hands. It seemed to grow bigger, to expand and the sun shone brighter than ever before. Everything around me floated in a radiant light, even the morning queue in front of the toilet. The eyes of the people